Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 6, 2005. Today's session is entitled Unconventional Wisdom in Ecclesiastes, presented by Jim Killo. Disc number KIJ2005-02.
This is the class on unconventional wisdom in the Bible, and my name is Jim Killo. I'm a pastor from Omaha, Nebraska, which many of you have driven through. This is the second of the four classes that we're doing on unconventional wisdom. If you missed Monday's session, it's going to be okay. I mean, you missed great stuff, I must admit. But what we did on Monday was to set the stage for talking about unconventional wisdom, which we will do today and tomorrow and the next day, by talking about conventional wisdom. And so Monday we looked at the book of Proverbs, which is kind of the book of conventional wisdom in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. Before we're going to do a recap of that, so if you weren't here, we'll catch you up. But I also want to recap a couple of things, which I call my class expectations. And I have three expectations when I lead a class. And the first one is that you are expected to interrupt me anytime you want, with questions, clarifications, comments. I really want this to be a dialogue and not a lecture by any means, so please jump in anytime. I also expect disagreement. You don't have to agree with me. I probably have to tell you that. I have to tell my congregation that because I'm their pastor. They have such high reverence for me. Probably not a problem here, but please feel free to disagree with me and each other. That's how we learn, is by disagreeing and civilly discussing our disagreements. And finally, I always expect that at the end of a good class, you have more questions than answers. The Bible is way too deep for us to give the answers. And so I hope what this does is raise a lot of questions. And I also love to say, I would love to talk about all the comments and questions and further conversations that took place after last Monday class, because a lot of you just had wonderful things to say and things that, but I want to keep myself from doing that just because there's so much great stuff to do today that I don't want to spend all that time on doing that. But I really appreciate all your comments. One thing I do need to comment on that Jeff mentioned that I should have made much more clear, and it's very important, especially today's text when we look at Ecclesiastes and tomorrow's text when we looked at Job, because it was equally true with last Monday's text on Proverbs. The people who wrote these scriptures, at this point in the development of Jewish theology, there was no afterlife in the sense of a heaven and hell. And so when they're talking about God blessing them with life, I think our Christian thing is that we jump right into afterlife and heavenly reward. That is never a part of the equation, Monday, today, or tomorrow. At this point in the development of Jewish theology, when you died, you went to Sheol, which was the place of the dead. It wasn't negative, it wasn't positive, it's just where dead people go. And so there was no sense of afterlife, so everything is an earthly reward or an earthly punishment. The only kind of continuation beyond your life would be your children and your family. That was kind of more what the afterlife was about. So it's real important when we read these texts that are talking about God giving me life or that kind of stuff, we're not talking afterlife. It's all very present. Why don't we start with the word of prayer? Well, let's not now start with the word of prayer, and then we'll review and then move on. Loving and gracious God, again we give you thanks for this chance to be together, this time apart. We pray, Lord, that in this hour that we have in front of us now, that you will draw us together, draw us into your word, open our hearts and minds to hear new things, to think new things, to be impacted by your word, that somehow we may become more faithful disciples, that we would be transformed, to be more closely returned to that image of you that we were created in. So bless our time together now. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So last week, last Monday, I usually do this in a weekly format, so if I say last week, I mean Monday. We talk about conventional wisdom, we looked at the book of Proverbs, and I think what we kind of talked about is that Proverbs is talking about wisdom. Wisdom is not an intellectual thing you learn so much. wisdom is the path of life that you choose to take. And the way that Proverbs talks about that was two different women. The wise woman who stood on the street corners called people to follow the ways of wisdom. They contrast that then with the strange woman or the loose woman who in the dark of the evening drops calls young men in to follow, you know, to come to her and commit adultery and go in a different way of life. And so that's kind of how Proverbs begins. And then the last part of the book of Proverbs is a bunch of little proverbs. And as we read the Proverbs that I zeroed in on, and I want to be real clear about that too. I don't want to give you the impression the whole book of Proverbs is like this. But the ones that I zeroed in on were the ones that made it sound pretty clear that God, the reason people are rich is because God blesses them. The reason people are poor is because God has cursed them. Likewise, those who survive a health thing is because God has blessed them. And those who die is because God has cursed them. It's a real conventional wisdom kind of cause and effect. That God is there doing that. And, you know, that sounds very strange to us. And we say, oh, that sounds horrible. And yet we also talked about the fact that that kind of conventional wisdom still is very much present in how we live and think. And we talked about how we will often say, oh, I've been blessed with this house, I've been blessed. We say, I've been blessed, and then we pop some material thing onto that. And we're not saying it directly, but the implication is that God has favored us with these things. On the other side, we talked about, and a number of pastors confirmed this with me, that my experience, when I go to the hospital with someone with a very serious illness, 9 out of 10 times, they say, what did I do to deserve this? That's conventional wisdom. If I'm suffering from cancer, I must have done something wrong. That's conventional wisdom. We also talk about now, conventional wisdom isn't bad. We want to say to our children, and someone made the comment that your daughter had your grandson read the book of Proverbs.
I did.
Yeah, she did. Okay, there's wonderful things in the book of Proverbs. And we want to say to our children, do right and you'll prosper. But it's so easily switched over to, if you do right, then God will reward you. And so that's kind of the up and down side of conventional wisdom. It turns God into a very predictable and controllable God. If I do right, then God will bless me. If I do wrong, then God will curse me. God is very just in conventional wisdom. You get what you deserve. Now, obviously, though, we know examples when that doesn't work. And we talked about specifically, there's one of the passages that we read from Proverbs that talks about, you know, when the storm rages, the evil will be wiped out. And the good shall make it out okay. And as I said, when I originally taught this class the first time, it was just after the hurricanes in Florida. And so I asked the people, so everyone who lost their house in the hurricanes, is that because they were evil? But you could easily grab 4 or 5 verses from Proverbs and proof text that and say, yeah, right here in the Bible. So that's the problem with conventional wisdom. And I think that problem has been around since the Bible was written because 2 specific biblical writers wrote books of unconventional wisdom, questioning if that's the way the world works. And one of those books we're going to look at today, which is the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, I think, is written in response to this notion of conventional wisdom. Now, the interesting thing, as we mentioned, I think, Monday, the book of Proverbs is said, if you read the very first chapter or verse of Proverbs, it says, these are the Proverbs of King Solomon, who was, of course, known as the wisest king. Well, guess who wrote the book of Ecclesiastes? King Solomon, the same guy, supposedly. And once again, this kind of bothers us modern people and say, oh, it would be horrible to write in someone's name. Not in this culture. In this culture, that was a great honor to write in the name of a wise person. But I think it's very interesting that they're both accredited to the same person. Questions about, are you clear on kind of the setup? Those of you who missed last week, anyone who was, last Monday, anyone who was here last Monday, is that what we talked about? Is that catching the gist? Okay. So with that in mind, let's look at the book of Ecclesiastes. Everything we look at today will be in the book of Ecclesiastes. You don't need to see the board, but everything that we're going to look at is up on the board. And so if that helps you. Oh, and also, I will quit digressing, I promise, after this. I do want to give credit to the person who I, or the book that I most use to develop that, and that is Marcus Borg's book, Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. I recommend all of Marcus Borg's book, but this one specifically is very helpful in helping you read the Bible again for the first time. And I also made a silly mistake last Monday. I said this was the latest book he wrote. It's not. I think it's the second of the latest book he wrote. And the only reason that's silly is our family that we're here with is reading his latest book this week together. So you think I would have known that, but I didn't. So we're going to look at Ecclesiastes now. There are two central metaphors or themes that reappear throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you open up to chapter 1, verse 2, there it is. I hope we have some different translations out there, because especially some of these little metaphors are said differently, and it's very rich, I think, to get some different wording. So when some people start reading, just read chapter or verse 2 to me, and then if someone has a different translation, just shoot that out too.
Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity.
Who has something different?
Meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless.
So we have vanity, we have meaningless, what else?
We have in the Tanakh.
Okay.
Utter futility, said Kohelet. Utter futility. All is futile.
Okay. Anything else besides
useless?
Useless. I think vanity is what the NRSV has, but I think sometimes that's a hard word for us because we think of vain as in, you know, I'm so vain I look at myself in the mirror too much. It's not that kind of vanity he's talking about. It's uselessness, futility, hopelessness kind of thing. So that's one of the themes that runs throughout of the book of Ecclesiastes, that things are meaningless. It's utter futility to understand things. And we'll flesh that out here. But that's one of the primary metaphors he uses. I'm not sure where I got these. Some translations use things like vapor or mist or fog. It's like we're in a fog. It's like things are vapors. You can't get a hold of them. It's futile, all that kind of imagery. The other major and that also, I mean, if you, for the fun of it, that 12:8, you'll just see the exact same thing. That same language here. Vanity of vanity, says the teacher, all is vanity. Toward the very end of the book. And so he begins and ends the book, bookends it with that notion that it's useless, it's futile. The other main metaphor he uses, and this is 1:14. Would someone want to read that for us?
I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun, and see all is vanity and the chasing after wind.
Okay, that chasing after wind is what I'm looking for. Other ways of that, instead of, does yours say something besides chasing after wind?
Striving.
Okay.
Pursuit. Grasping.
Okay. And all those things. Can you grasp, chase, pursue the wind? What is that if you try that?
Futile.
It's futile. It's absolutely futile. Okay, 1:17.
And I applied my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a chasing after wind.
Okay, 2:11.
Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun.
And we could go on seven more times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. He says it's like chasing the wind. Yes, ma'am.
It sounds like what he's saying is, though, anything that I achieved, so the material realm, or what is it when you say it's futile? What are you
we'll get there.
Okay.
That, yeah. Okay. But I just wanted to familiarize you with the language that he's going to use to describe this. I should have asked, I meant to ask earlier, did anybody actually read the book before? I said at the end of last class, if you were really good, you would read the book beforehand. Did anybody do that? Anybody get double extra bonus points? Never mind. Okay. I quickly find out how much authority I have, so I'm not worried about disagreeing with you now at all.
It was a holiday.
I'm not reading Ecclesiastes on a holiday.
It's all vanity.
It's all
vanity. Okay, so now that we have those two central metaphors down, let's start figuring out what he's talking about. Supposedly, King Solomon is writing this book, and he's testing out conventional wisdom. That's how he begins. He's heard all the conventional wisdom. If I do right, I'll be rewarded. If I'm the wisest guy in the world, then my life will go smooth. All these things. So he's going to put those all to the test. And that's what he does at the beginning of the book. And so we're going to read kind of straight through here, but I'll break it up in little chunks. So where do we start? We start back in 1, 12 through 18. And once again, would someone just start reading and I might interrupt you.
I, the teacher, when king over Israel in Jerusalem, applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to be busy with. I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun, and see, all is vanity and chasing after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a chasing after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow.
So what's he saying about his pursuit of wisdom? It didn't get anywhere. And is it because he didn't try hard enough? I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. My mind had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I became the smartest guy around. And what does conventional wisdom say, that if you're the smartest guy around, you should prosper. Life should make sense. Life should be easy. You figure it all out. Is it that way?
In reading Ecclesiastes, though, I didn't get the impression it contradicts conventional wisdom, but that it questions its purpose. I mean, so what? So you've got this great life. So what? What's it get me, really?
I bring that back up at the end, because I would say there's some... it doesn't contradict it, but what?
It questions
the questions
purpose
okay.
of conventional wisdom. I don't get the impression that the writer of Ecclesiastes is living a pauper's life, or like in Job, has been afflicted with a bad life. I think he's got a great life.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And he's got all the wealth, and he's got all the wisdom, and what's it for? Who cares? That's what I keep.
Okay, but see, I think conventional wisdom would say, if you have all those things,
you should be happy.
Then you'll be happy.
Yeah.
If you're wise and you're faithful, God will bless you, and you'll be happy. Life is predictable, controllable. So it's not like and once we'll come back, that's kind of the conclusion. You're jumping to the end again, people. So hold on to that. Okay, so wisdom does not get him anywhere. How about, someone read 2:1-11.
I said to myself, come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But again, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it?
I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly until I might see what was good for mortals to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and delights of the flesh and many concubines. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had spent in doing it, and again, all was vanity and chasing after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun.
So what does he try next to satisfy him?
Pleasure.
Wealth and pleasure. Does that sound like anybody you know? I mean, isn't this our culture? You know, as I was reading that, I was kind of doing a new translation. I made pools for myself. I put in a sprinkler system, which we're just guilty of doing. It is the most marvelous thing. But you know, this is just us.
And then you have to mow the grass.
Exactly. It's all vanity. Now the grass grows faster. Thank God I have two teenage sons. But one is right next to you, so he's agreeing. Please don't give him any fodder. He does not need his encouragement. Once again, conventional wisdom says if you have the right stuff, you'll be happy, you'll be fulfilled. Does it turn out that way for the teacher?
No.
Still all vanity. He gets, and once again, you can see the hyperbole in this, probably. But you know, once again, it's not that he didn't try. He did it. He got more than anybody else. It's not as if he would have just tried a little harder. He's tried. He's accomplished all his goals in pleasure seeking and wealth. Still totally useless. 2:12-17, please.
Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom, and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me, all of it meaningless, a chasing after the wind.
So what is he hoping here will give him meaning?
Wisdom.
Let's pause it 1 second. He's not bashing conventional wisdom. I think he's in the same bind that we've talked about. I mean, he says, what is it? 13, then I saw that wisdom exceeds folly as light excels darkness. It's not that wisdom is bad. You still have to strive for wisdom. But in the end, it's still meaningless. Yeah, you're still there. I think part of this is life and reputation. You know, if I'm the wisest and my life is a shining example, that'll give me meaning. But then he realizes, he's going to be forgotten just like the bum down the street. Everyone dies. Death comes to all of us. And once again, that's extra poignant if there's no afterlife. There's no heavenly reward here. It's not as if that's where he'll find meaning or reward. Life is now. And life is meaningless.
There must be something more.
And we'll get there. There it is. Okay, one more chunk here. 2:18-23, please.
I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun? All his days, his work is pain and grief. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless.
I just love that phrase, even at night, their minds do not rest. Once again, something that written, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, they stayed up late at night worrying about stuff too. And what is it worrying about?
More stuff.
More stuff. You know, I built this great business, and the next CEO might be a jerk. Or, and once again, you put this in King Solomon, I built this great temple. Well, it's not going to be long from now this great temple is going to be wiped off the face of the earth. And, you know, Solomon is the last king of the United Kingdom. Right? Yeah, as soon as I said that, I was panicked for a second. It's Solomon's sons who fight and kill each other, and the kingdom divides, and the great country of Israel that he and his father built up is wiped out soon. It's all vanity.
How about built this great church?
Yeah. And then next pastor's going to come along and screw it up.
And also there's the feeling of somebody who doesn't deserve it will
get
what I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even if he or she doesn't screw it up, but yeah.
I think the idea of leaving everything for someone else is an interesting concept.
Mm-hmm. There's some of that with Holden. Holden is such a mixture of people over the years, and the dream that starts it, and then the people go, and then the people go, and the people go, and it's always new people coming in with just a little trickle of the memory that brings back.
Okay, so are you thoroughly depressed yet? That, you know, usually when I ask if you would have, which is fine, then, but if you would have read the book beforehand, usually people's response is, oh, this is a depressing book. But we've got to get a little more depressing before we shed some light here. One of the things we talked about from Proverbs, conventional wisdom, is that the righteous always prosper. If you do well, if you're good, if you're righteous, God will reward you. Well, he has some problems. Well, not problems with that, he just sees things differently. 7:15-18.
In my vain life, I have seen everything. There are righteous people who perish in their righteousness, and there are wicked people who prolong their life in their evil doing. Do not be too righteous, and do not act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be too wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of the one without letting go of the other. For the one who fears God shall succeed with both. Wisdom gives strength to the wise.
That's fine, thank you. So, he recognizes that that's not the case. And so what's his advice? I love this advice. Don't be too good. Heaven forbid. Life is too short to be too good. But don't be too bad. Everything in moderation.
Play it safe.
I'm sorry?
Play it safe.
Yeah. But I even hear more than that. I kind of hear, take some risks.
But
yeah,
not too much.
Yeah, just that's that nice balancing act. How about same theme, 8:14.
There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked, and there are wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous. I said this is also vanity. So
okay,
that's
fine. So I'm just that same thing. It's not the way that conventional wisdom said it was going to be. Finally, the exact same thing. Just want to drive it deeply into you. 9, 11, and 12.
Before you jump there, it's interesting because earlier in the Tanakh, vanity was futileness or futility.
Mm-hmm.
Here, it's translated as frustration.
Can you read that for us?
Here is a frustration that occurs in the world. Sometimes an upright man is requited according to the conduct of the scoundrel, and sometimes the scoundrel is requited according to the conduct of the upright. I say all that is frustration.
Hmm. Which, haven't we all felt that?
Mm-hmm.
You see bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people, and you say, why is that? That's not the way it's supposed to be. And yet, it is, right? Happens all the time. Okay, once again, same thing, final one, 9, 11, and 12, please.
Again, I saw that under the sun, the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to the skillful, but time and chance happen to them all. For no one can anticipate the time of disaster, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare. So mortals are snared at the time of calamity when it suddenly falls upon them.
Once again, don't we teach our children, if you practice enough and you're fast enough, you'll win the race. All this conventional wisdom is not wrong. I mean, it's what we teach people. The battle usually is to the strong. The bread is to the wise. Get a good education, child, so you can get a good job, so you can have a nice life. That's conventional wisdom. It's all right. We all say it. But we also know, does getting a good education, getting a good job, guarantee that their life is going to go smooth as silk?
No.
Calamity falls upon everyone. That is the way it is, and the writer is making sure that he's pointing that out to us. Not what conventional wisdom taught him. Okay, so now if you're thoroughly depressed, we'll start turning around here. If conventional wisdom is not all that it's cracked up to be, how should we live our lives? And that goes back to what he said a few moments ago. Don't be too good in the sense that you think if you're just good enough, then everything's going to go right. If that's your philosophy, you're going to be frustrated. You're chasing after the wind. And so what do we do? What, once again, wisdom is not an intellectual exercise. It's the path we take in life. And so if we would love the path to be smooth and predictable and controllable. If I do good, then I'll be treated good. We'd all love for that. But he's saying, obviously, that's not the way the world works. And so what are we going to do? Do we just throw up our hands and say, to heck with it, I'll just live however I want, because obviously the predictable, controllable God doesn't work, so maybe there is no God, and I'll just do whatever makes me happy. That's one option. He's going to give us a different path to take. Now, where is that? It is in 2:24-26. Back up here.
A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind.
Let's look at three verses together, then we'll come back and talk, because they're all very related. So hold off if you have any, we're going to talk about that for a second. Flip over to 3:12, 3:13.
I know that there is nothing better for them than to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. Moreover, it is God's gift that all should eat and drink and take pleasure.
Thank you. And once again, 9, 7 through 10.
Go eat your bread with enjoyment, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has long ago approved what you do. Let your garments always be white. Do not let oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love, all the days of your vain life that you are given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Seol to which you are going.
So what's his answer? How should we live our lives? What path should we take?
Enjoy yourself.
Abundance of love.
Love people. Love your family. And look on your work as a calling.
Okay.
I think that it's a gift, and we all know that we can put on the righteousness of Christ. That's when he died for us. And so if we have his, hold ourselves with that and receive the joy. It's about receiving. All this was I get wealth, I do this, I do that. And I think we have to let go of that and just receive the gifts that Christ died to give us.
Okay.
We're saying, and then we will try to do what's right and what's a good life.
And what are the three specific gifts that he's saying that we've been given that we should enjoy?
Eat.
Drink.
And
be merry. If only he had said that. If only we could rewind it and have put Mary in there. He never says that. He says we should eat, drink, and
work.
Not just work.
Enjoy the toil.
Enjoy the toil that we have been given.
Yeah.
Mary would be so much better than that, wouldn't it? We are called to eat. We're not called. His recommendation is he invites us to eat, drink, and enjoy the labor that we've been given.
I think a key part of it, though, too, is in 2:25, where he says, for apart from him, meaning God, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Because it sounds like he's doing that anyway. In trying to live the normal life, but that word jumped out at me.
Yeah, he does bring God into it. How is this understanding of how God is involved in our lives different from the conventional wisdom understanding of how God is involved in our lives?
We should not expect, but we should thank.
Okay, yeah. It's not a matter of
earning, but gift.
Not earning, right. Not trying to control God.
Not a reward.
To receive, because these two are also from God. God has given you food and wine. Thank you, God. And unfortunately, toil. God has given us good things to do.
And a good wife.
And a good wife. That's right. Isn't that beautiful? So that's his answer. That's this guy's answer to conventional wisdom. Instead of trying to control God so that your life will be good, it's eat, drink, and enjoy your work. That's where meaning comes from in life. Now there's a few other things that he also is going to tack on here. This next one is tough, but let's give it a shot here. I struggle with this one a little bit, if you can help me out. 7, 1 through 4. And he's going to talk about how death teaches us to live. So 7, let me find it here real quick before I talk to you. 7, 1 through 4. Time out. I'm in the Song of Solomon, and it'll make no sense. Okay, now I'm ready.
It might.
A good name is better than fine perfume, and a day of death better than a day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure.
Okay. What do you think about that? What is he trying to say? What do you hear him saying?
live like you were dying. I mean, it's like that Tim McGraw song. I mean, if you acknowledge that you know that you are going to die, that maybe you will appreciate life more.
Okay.
I think I've heard it said, until we accept our mortality, we don't know how to live.
Okay. Likewise,
some people dodge places of death. We teach our children, many of us have taught our children, don't go to funerals, it's too sad.
Mm-hmm.
It always bothered me when people protected their children from death when they were often the most open to accept that as a part of reality. And people, having worked 10 years in a nursing home, absolutely came in the door and got out as quickly as they could. They're surrounded by signs of terminal illness, great confusion, mortality. It's a very uncomfortable place.
What happens if we avoid the subject of our own mortality?
It's vanity.
It's unavoidable.
But if we deny that, if we refuse to acknowledge that we too, possibly tomorrow, may die, what does that lead us to when we totally refuse to acknowledge our own mortality?
One thing is you're missing a part of your life.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. We'll leave a lot of things undone if we don't realize that.
Because we always say to ourselves,
yeah.
We can always do it tomorrow. We can always do it tomorrow. My wife and I, when we were on our honeymoon, we were in British. Where were we, Deb? Victoria. Which doesn't really matter, but that's where we were. And we were walking in a sidewalk, and I remember we stopped at a street corner, and there was an elderly woman who asked us what we were doing. It's a conversation. We said we're on our honeymoon, and she said, I wish I would have wrote it down, because I don't remember exactly what she said, but what the point she was making is she said something about how she and her husband had saved and saved and saved and saved, so that when they retired, they could do all this traveling, and then he retired and died the next week. And so now she had all the money that she could ever use, and she was alone. And so to tell a newly-wedded couple to enjoy life now, unbelievably profound wisdom. You know, death teaches us about life. If we pretend we're not going to die, it's so easy to say, I'll just do it later. And I think what Ecclesiastes is saying is, no.
Pastor,
I think it could go a little farther than that, too. Not just death, but if you ask a psychiatrist, how do people learn to grow through the hard times? And since hard times are always part of our lives, we may as well expect they're going to happen and figure out ways to grow through them, because the good times, which we easily forget, don't seem to happen a lot. The other ones do.
Yeah. And I think that's tied up in that conventional wisdom again, because I think conventional wisdom, deep in ourselves, we believe that if we're good, we're not going to have hard times. One of the things I do, marriage counseling, one of the inventory I use, there's a section called Marriage Expectations that asks them questions like, I will never question the love for my partner, will never have serious problems, this is the only person I could ever love, you know, and what do you expect people who are engaged to answer those things? They all say, oh, of course, we'll never have problems, we'll always be in love, the romantic love will always stay the same. And then I have to be the one to say, guess what, guys? The day is coming when you're going to say, this was the biggest mistake of my life. How could I have ever made this mistake? Because we don't think things are bad are going to happen to us. Because, especially if we're good people who've been influenced by this tradition that God takes care of good people, right? Which I want to say that God does, but it doesn't save us from bad things happening. I think that's terribly profound for all of us to recognize. It's not if something bad is going to happen to us, it is when something bad is going to happen to us. And that's when our faith becomes, we find out what our faith is.
Isn't this saying more than that in this passage, though? It seems to me it's saying more than just, you know, we're all going to die, so deal with it.
and you know, just and make what you can out of life. I mean, it's saying things in here. It's better to go to a house of mourning. The day of death is better than the day of birth. And that's the part I'm struggling with in reading this part is it kind of seems out of context because it doesn't give you the in the sense that you talked about earlier where there's no afterlife. And it's hard to put in context. Well, why is it good on this earthly life to be sad? Why is sorrow better than laughter? That part I'm struggling with.
And I struggle with that too. But I think... Oh, please.
It seems to me that this is also speaking not only about the importance of doing and living in the moment, but even more about the depth of love. So when you are jolly and you are denying death, you really don't allow yourself to deeply, deeply love because that requires that we then have sorrow when that person dies. So that it's really addressing deeply love and that... then that's the most important thing. Not all the doing this, but really being in relationship. So that's another thought.
And I think it also has the dying to self. I think you have to do that, and that we can do daily. Like sometimes we have to die to ourselves and putting away our preference for our spouse or doing something for a friend that you could. Every day we have to die little by little to our desires, mm-hmm. and that's like... you know, becoming more like Christ. We can have all the knowledge, and that's what causes the torment, is the more we study God's word, the more knowledge we have, and then the more we hope we can't do it, and that causes the anxiety and the worry, you know, because I just can't do it all. But little by little, I think you're saying, you know, give up some of these things that, and, you know, mm-hmm. you could be surrounded in the most beautiful place and be with the most miserable people, and I think we've all experienced that. We'd rather go and be someplace with some people. You know, we all have examples, we all have mentors, and they're usually the older mm-hmm. people that have lived generations ago.
Go ahead.
What that first sentence means to me, kind of to answer that question. Over there, a good name is better than fine perfume, which to me says a legacy, you know, what you're leaving behind. And the day of death is better than the day of birth. When you die, if you have followed his recommendations, you will have left a legacy of satisfaction and die with a smile. And that would be better than when you are born with all the possibilities, all the directions that you can go. If when you die, you have, you know, considered God and followed that path, you die feeling good.
And you know, that there's a lot of credence that can be given to that. If, I don't know if your Bibles do this. Mine shows that 7 is in verse. If you notice you notice how it goes from paragraphs above to verse. So that's a poem that begins in chapter 7, which also lets us know, not to take this literally, this is poetic, metaphorical language. But the other thing about Hebrew poetry is that it's there's a parallel. So the first line, the second line restates the first line. And so, you know, I think, Gary, a good name is better than precious oil, ointment. Then the line that clarifies that or backs that up is the second line. And the day of death better than the day of birth. So maybe I think that's a very helpful way of, always a useful way of interpreting poetry in the Hebrew Bible, is to look at that next line and see how it supports that. Elaine, did you have?
I did. The rabbi isn't here, and I'm an educated Jew, but there's a Jewish person in your midst. And I was taught that when a baby is born, there's much trepidation, and it's presumptuous to get baby things in your home because it's presumptuous to assume that they'll be healthy and that you'll eat. And that was how it was a long time ago. And I think that's what we're talking about, to your point about it's better to go to the house of mourning. Because if someone has lived a full life and without thinking of heaven, that is something to really rejoice. If they've had a long life, a full life, that's really something to marvel at. And so it's a little bit inverse of what you think of, the joy of a baby's birth. And that was really fraught with much more trepidation than I think we think of.
And that is so helpful. That's always, I think I want to say one out of please feel free to correct me because I'm just shooting in the dark here. 1 out of 5 babies made it past the age of 2 in this culture. Maybe less than that, yeah. I can't remember if it's 1 out of 10, but it's phenomenal. And it's so hard for us. So yeah, the original people who read this, wrote this, heard this, they would have, all this would have hit them very differently, I think, than us. Because once again, we are a culture that denies death. This was a culture that was surrounded by death.
Well, and I'm really glad you said what you did, because I've been puzzling over the footnote to this verse in the Tanakh, which I couldn't figure out what the relationship was. It says, stillbirths were cast into pits or hidden in the ground with no recognizable graves. In other words, no name that lives on after them. Whereas at the end of your life, your name, you've created what the association with your name.
Well, there's another passage that deals with the same kind of theme. So it's a 12, 1 through 8. And can you read that out of the Tanakh for us? So read the first verse, then pause, and I want to compare it with our versions, then we'll read the rest.
So appreciate your vigor in the days of your youth. Before those days of sorrow come and those years arrive of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them.
It's the NRSV, which I assume is similar to what most of you guys have, remember your creator in the days of your youth. Mm-hmm. Is that how yours starts?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have my own Bible because I don't want to carry it, it's too big and heavy. But if there's a footnote in any of yours, you'll see that the word creator there might be the word death. Because the two were, I guess, and I'm not a Hebrew scholar, it'd be great if Rabbi Marks were here. I think the two words are kind of spelled the same or sound the same. And so this might be a mistranslation, which in a sense makes it make more sense. If you read, remember your grave in the day of your youth. It's that same notion of let your death make you realize the worth of your life. So now, but someone, go ahead and finish that off through 8, please, if you would.
Before sun and light and moon and stars grow dark and the clouds come back again after the rain. Then it goes into verse. When the guards of the house become shaky and the men of valor are bent and the maids that grind grown few are idle and the ladies that peer through the windows grow dim and the doors to the street are shut, with the noise of the handmill growing fainter and the song of the bird growing feebler and all the strains of music dying down, when one is afraid of heights and there is terror on the road, for the almond tree may blossom, the grasshopper be burdened, and the caper bush may bud again, but man sets out for his eternal abode with mourners all around in the street. Before the silver cord snaps and the golden bowl crashes, the jar is shattered at the spring, and the jug is smashed at the cistern. And the dust returns to the ground as it was, and the life breath returns to God who bestowed it. Utter futility, said Keola. All is futile.
So it's that same kind of complicated theme of let your death help inform your living. I want to keep us moving on here. I'm so sorry. The time is going way too fast. The most famous passage of Ecclesiastes, thanks to the birds, I think, is
yes.
Chapter 3, 1 through 8, for everything there is a season. If anyone wants to sing that for us, they may. Otherwise, if someone would just quickly read this, I want to just quickly zip through this. So 3, 1 through 8.
For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace.
Once again, besides this being beautiful poetry, I think it fits into this overall theme of the book, which is that whole sense of kind of living in the present. There's everything has its time. Don't rush it. Don't live in the future. Everything has its place and time, and don't get ahead of yourself. And I think that's really the theme of this book. I think, once again, he's saying the rewards of conventional wisdom don't work. Reality is such that the righteous are not always rewarded, the wicked are not always punished. Instead, it's the other way around sometimes. And sometimes, you know, death comes to the good. And so death is random. Reality is not orderly, but instead it's crooked. And so life, for the Ecclesiastes, is not about pursuing rewards of conventional wisdom, but instead simply living in the present. Because once again, if we convince ourselves that if we're just good now, then the reward will come, it doesn't always work that way. And so his advice is, eat, drink, and take joy in your work. That's what God has given you. And he gives it to you today.
Every day.
And so if we get caught up in that conventional wisdom stuff, we're going to be disappointed. Some of us will. Some of us won't. Right? You know people who've lived good lives, and they lived long lives, and conventional wisdom worked for them. But don't trust it. So eat, drink, and be merry while you work.
But you don't know. When you say that, you're making a judgment about what went on in the mind of that person who was obviously successful. They could have enjoyed their work, and they could have eaten and drink and all of these things, and still succeeded. I mean, I read this, and I think Donald Trump could probably write this book. It's a guy that has succeeded well that could write a book like this that anyone would hold to be any truth at all. If someone who is a failure wrote this book, who would listen to it?
But I wonder how many nights Trump laid awake.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe he doesn't. I don't know.
His wife?
Yeah. But what I mean is we look into someone else's mind.
Sure.
And we don't know what goes on inside their mind, and so we become judgmental when we do that.
Yeah, and I'm definitely tripping myself in his mind. It's not fair to do that. Sorry, sir?
I was going to agree with that. We can't look into someone else. We can observe and say, hey, that person's life seemed to be smooth. But there's no way we can make that final judgment because he could have been tormented through the
whole
thing.
Yeah, exactly. So if we said the image of God in Proverbs was of a God who was predictable, controllable, what's the image of God in Ecclesiastes?
Well, you can't control God.
Okay, can't control God.
Kind of absent.
It seems as if, but why was there some noise? I heard some groaning.
Well, I was going to say just the opposite. God is present.
God gives us a glorious day every day with what we need.
Because if he's present, then all the time, then we just take what we're given on a daily basis. If he's not, then we're expecting him to intercede in a conventional form.
Okay.
And that doesn't happen.
Okay, so Ecclesiastes would say that God is not interventionalist. Is that a word?
Yeah.
It sounded great, didn't it?
Good.
There were many syllables. So we don't have an interventionist God in Ecclesiastes. I would agree we have a present God, but I think God is mystery, Ecclesiastes. Once again, a conventional God is much easier. It's so much easier if God would just do things right and reward the righteous and punish the wicked. That's not the way God works. So the two options are, either there is no God, or God is present but mysterious, uncontrollable. We don't know why it works out, but that God is present. And I would say, once again, going back to that, because God gives you your eating and your drinking and your toil, the author of Ecclesiastes has not given up on God.
And he'll help you when you need it. And he'll help you when you need it. He'll see you through.
Okay, yeah.
No matter how tough it is, he'll
He'll see you through.
Maybe not in the way you want.
The sense that I get in Ecclesiastics is that he's saying the key to a good life, or the key to happiness, is realizing that God is a companion and God is in the world with you and in what you eat and in what you do and in what you drink. And it's that realization day after day after day that gives value to your life.
And once again, if you think of this as in terms of a path of a way to follow, so what difference is that going to make in your path if you change from thinking about God as the great rewarder or punisher, which is conventional wisdom, very simplified, to God as a companion on the way? And how we image God really affects how we walk, our Christian walk. And I think a lot of us, most of us, I know I do, have a lot of unlearning to do. Because what was beat into me, I don't understand that being integrated at all. But what I was just taught was that God was the big watchdog in the sky, watching me, and if I did wrong, he would zap me. Last comment.
Well, I think of it as the companion God walking with you, being with you, and not somebody you're trying to provoke. I mean, if you think that conventional wisdom, that you deserve that, God's supposed to give you conventional wisdom, so you're angry with your God all the time. And the difference between that and just walking through your life with God beside you.
Yeah. Giving up this notion that we can in any way control God, which
right.
We all love to do. We're out of time. Tomorrow, let me see, tomorrow, we're back in this room at 3:45 and Book of Job, who's also asking the same questions. If you want to, not the whole book, it's ridiculously long, but the first two chapters would give you a nice, and we'll go back over them in the session, but the more familiarity you have with that opening story that sets up the Book of Job, it'd be better. So, thank you so very much for your comments and everything.